WFAE streaming is funded by Garage Door Guru, providing local comprehensive garage door service for over 12 years, including detailed repairs and door installations, offering fine German-made garage doors. Details, go garagedoorguru.com.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The town of Davidson grew up around Davidson College, which was established in what was a largely rural area in the mid-1830s. But when Davidson College professor of history Ralph Levering and college archivist Jan Blodgett sat down to write their history of Davidson, they concentrated more on the town than just the college that birthed it. And unlike previous works on the subject, they wanted to take a comprehensive look at Davidson by including not just the educated academics, but also the working class mill whites and the African Americans who lived in and contributed to the town. Their book is called One Town, Many Voices, Davidson, North Carolina, and Jan Blodgett and Ralph Levering join us for the hour. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back, I should say to you, because you've been here many times, Ms. Dr. Levering. There's at least one other history of Davidson that I know about. In fact, you reference it in the preface to your book, Mary Beatty's Davidson, A History of the Town, 1935 to 1937. And obviously a lot of stuff has happened between 1835. But a lot of stuff has happened between 1937 and today. Is that why you wanted to write this, to further up, to bring the history up to date, or were there other motivations here?
The primary motivation for me was that there was a group in town called Common Ground. It was that people got together and talked about many issues, including racial issues. And there was a meeting one evening, and ministers from the local churches were discussing issues around Davidson that they saw from their perspective in their various pulpits. And one of the members was Claire Hurst, who was then minister at Reeves Temple Amy Zion Church. And Claire, if you're still out there, hi. She's an amazing person. Claire talked about taking the job and coming into Davidson and being all excited about this new community and walking downtown and, you know, looking like enjoying Main Street and finding a bookstore and being very excited. And then going in and finding the town history and not finding a lot about the African-American community, and then sort of noticing that she wasn't seeing the African-American community on Main Street. And she used the word invisible, that she felt like the community was invisible. And I was sitting in the audience, and this little light went off my head and said, you know, I could do something about that. I'm an archivist. I believe in the power of stories. That's what I do, is I capture the stories of communities or institutions. And so I thought right then, this is something I could give back to the town of Davidson. I could gather everyone's stories. I could make sure that people know the full history. And that launched the book. Then what happened was I remembered I hate writing. You know, I've written two books already. I should know this. And also the long process of getting people to trust me with their stories. You can't just blithely pop in. I moved to Davidson in 1994. I started this in the late 90s. So I was still a very, very newcomer. 18 years later, I'm still a newcomer to Davidson. So there was a period of just being with people, attending community events, listening, talking. And then there was also this wonderful period when Ralph stepped in and for his own reasons.
Is this like The Help? In other words, in the movie The Help, the book The Help, the white writers chronicling the story or taking down the stories of these
To a certain extent, that there was that sense, and also the mill community, finding the people. And I was very much aware that my walking in as this middle-aged white woman to say, tell me your stories, that could be a very threatening or challenging kind of thing. And I had to earn respect and say, I'm going to take care of these stories. I'm not going to take them from them. I'm not going to take your story and tell them in a different way. And that's actually one of the things that I'll put a plug in now. We're hoping the book does is encourage people to tell more stories.
Is this how history is written? Ralph Levering, you're a history professor. Is it written by people writing down other people's stories?
I think it is. But it's written more by people who have an internal need to get stories recorded and out. I think, for example, most of my books have been on American foreign policy and the influence of the public on American foreign policy. And I think that's because my parents tried to influence American foreign policy as coming from the public point of view and not from the government. Mm-hmm. So I think there's something inside people who spend years writing history books that has to do with some need to connect or tell people stories. And I think the main thing that everyone should know about this book, which I think Jan has already alluded to, is that it never would have happened without Jan if she hadn't gotten it started and written the first four chapters before I became involved. But I think you're right. I think there is a desire to tell stories that's at the heart of writing history.
Here's what's curious to me about this. It was your idea, Jan, to do this, and you came up with the idea of collecting people's stories. And yet, the book, the responsibilities that the two of you had for this book are divided up. And Dr. Levering picks up in 1941 and goes to the present, and you kind of, as an archivist, go back and chronicle the early days. There can't be many people walking around Davidson with stories about what it was like when they moved there in 1837. All the storytelling, did it fall on Dr. Levering?
A fair amount of it. And some of what I did actually fed his chapters.
Okay.
Yeah, and we did, for my part of the book, my issue was I didn't have a lot of the stories. I had to find where things were, whereas he had way too much information and he had to sort of sort through it. So I spent my time reading trustee and faculty minutes. And I'm very grateful to Mary Beatty, who wrote the first town history, and her predecessor, Cornelia Shaw, who wrote a college history that has some town, and Mary Beatty's college history. They're wonderful works, and they're works of their time, and I use them all the time. So I wasn't trying to throw those out. But so, yeah, a lot of reading of our college minutes, because the college was the town government until 1879.
Right.
We were basically, we do have student letters. We do have president's wives who left correspondence with their family. There actually are some people who had family stories who remembered. Rebecca Shaw, who was a librarian who wrote a history of the college in the 1920s, wrote a lot of alums, and we have all of her correspondence and their letters. So we actually have people who attended Davidson in the 1890s and 1900s who were writing her and talking about what they remember the shops that they shopped in, accounts of students' interactions with African Americans. So I had to find all of these reminiscences and stories, some over in Chapel Hill, some were other places, and find the stories and then talk to people to see if I could fill in some of the gaps.
You're the college archivist.
Mm-hmm.
What does a college archivist do? What is your day-to-day job?
My job is to identify and capture and then make available all of the documents that record the history of the institution. So in the course of a day, there could be a trustee meeting, there could be faculty meetings, there could be student organizations meeting, business offices working away. The general rule of thumb is about 5-7% of any documents that are created, electronic or paper, in the course of a day at a college are worth keeping. And my idea of keeping is forever, 500 mm-hmm. years from now, 1,000 mm-hmm. years from now. And it's my job to find those things, make sure they make it into the archives, make sure that they get described in a way that can be used. And then when the alumni office needs a photograph for a project, or development needs a quote from a previous president, or sports information needs some background, or a student needs to do research for a history paper, then it's my job to answer the phone, meet with them, and get the information together.
Is all of this material, including the older material, being digitized now so that you can do a data search, like type in a search term and it'll, mm-hmm. it'll come up from 1850?
A goodly percentage of it is. Mm-hmm. We have not done all of it. Our trustee and faculty minutes are not digitized yet,
right.
But we do have, there was a student magazine that started in 1886, and they always included a column called Local News, mm-hmm. and the guys were very good about keeping track of every young lady who went off to college and all the friends that she brought home for Easter and summer break, new businesses, and as I was researching, I was typing those up, and we put those online, so mm-hmm. you can search. So if your family lived in Davidson in the 1890s, you're a Sloan, you can type in the word Sloan and find every time somebody, usually a Sloan daughter who's gone to college, is back in town visiting, but you can find information about it. We have our student letters digitized. The college catalogs are all now digitized. All of our local newspapers from the 30s and 40s that local school students did and ran, we've digitized,
wow.
and they're all on the archives website.
I want to hear about this from both of you, and I didn't plan to talk about this, but because you are an archivist and because you deal with history on a daily basis, and you are a history professor, and you deal with history on a daily basis, and you mentioned, Jan, that you have all these pieces of correspondence, private correspondence from earlier times. Today, we don't write letters. So much of that is not going to be around. We send text messages. We tweet. We keep documents in electronic form. And the way you read those documents is very likely to change over the next 50 years or so. So what do you think about? Where will future historians, if somebody comes along in 100 years and wants to write a follow-up to your book, where will they go? What will they access? What will there be to access?
I think it's going to be difficult because Jan got so many good stories for her chapters from letters that people had written back home. And there just aren't as many letters from 1941 to the present for the more recent period. And so if I hadn't interviewed people and if I hadn't used Jan's interviews that she did, I would not have the stories that I was able to use. So I think every 20 years or so, people need to do interviews about people who've lived in the town in a particular period and get those in the archive so that there will be material that people can go to.
And these letters, I've always been curious about this because, you know, Ken Burns did all the Civil War documentary series on using a lot of letters. Did the letters come from the recipient's files or did the senders keep a copy of the letter and that's where it came from?
It's a little bit of both.
Because that would be difficult to do prior to Xerox.
Yeah. Well, there used to be a tradition that when someone died, a lot of times they would send the letters back to the family. A lot of the letters came in before I got to Davidson as the archivist. Dr. Chalmers Davidson was the previous archivist. And so a number of things came in from alumni families. They found them in the attic or someone found it and it was addressed to Davidson College and they would send them to us. Although I'll note to your question that as archivists, what we've seen is lots of letter writing. We had a really hard time when telephones first came on because suddenly people were doing stuff, particularly businesses, on the phone instead of writing a memo or writing notes. And so there was this gap. And email actually has turned out to be a pretty good thing because people have printed off emails and saved them. We're now getting to the point, we're not quite at Davidson yet, but we're getting there where we can capture emails, the important ones, and save them and make them more searchable. So in some ways, historians are going to have an easier time because they can go through a computer file, a president's office emails, look for a topic, a name, and be able to find them and not have to read through 50 pages of stuff. So there's ups and downs on all the technologies when they come, but I think we're actually going to be able to capture some stuff that we didn't before.
You've written other books in the past, including religious fiction, but your research involves understanding the stories that communities tell about themselves. Flesh that out a little bit. How do we tell stories about ourselves traditionally, and are they usually flattering?
Most of the time we try to be flattering. I started in this work actually when I was working on my master's thesis in Texas and was researching the land promotion for the last of the Great American Desert. We're selling off all the farmers in Ohio ran out of farmland. They're looking for farmland and they're looking around Levelland, Texas, which is flat and dry and arid. And all of these people who were trying to sell land created stories. They created images and they created stories about community and fertility and a civic pride. And they would have these, you know, end up having chamber of commerce. And in those communities, they were trying to appeal to people who wanted to live on the land, who believed in, you know, sort of the American dream of, and you could just sort of read the stories around them. Mm-hmm. When I was looking at religious fiction, the stories they were telling are very much, you know, who's a good guy, who's a bad guy? What are our values? So looking at the town of Davidson, what I started hearing were same stories told from different perspectives. So mill people would have a different story about an event in town. The African-American community would have a different one. College would. So it's putting them together.
We'll talk about that, the distilling of information here in a second. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Charlotte Symphony. Christopher Warren Green conducts Night Sounds tomorrow. Mozart, Leonard Bernstein, John Lennon, and more. Includes a reception before the concert in Night Theater. Tickets at charlottesymphony.org. And Creative Loafing, where readers can find information and offers every day on entertainment, food, and more at cltdeals.com. Coming up tomorrow on Charlotte Talks, computers and the internet have become useful tools that we control to our benefit. True, but it turns out that these modern conveniences are also exerting a certain amount of control over us, and in the process are rewiring our brains. Our behavior's changing because of our interaction with the internet. Don't believe it? Then join our conversation at Lenoir Rhine University with Nicholas Carrs, author of The Shallows. That's When Charlotte Talks tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE. And if you'd like to go to the event tonight, go to our website, WFAE.org.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a new California law allows self-driving cars on state roads. Proponents promise computer-controlled vehicles will reduce accidents and congestion. The future of driving in the digital age.
That's the topic on the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks. On listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about a brand new book called Our Town, Many Voices, The History of Davidson, The Town and the College, not just the college, by Jan Blodgett, who's the archivist with Davidson College, and Dr. Ralph Levering, who is the Vail Professor of History there. They have collaborated on this book. You can read more about, and we're going to talk about some of the particular stories in this book as we go through the hour, but you can read more stories about Davidson history from davidsonnews.net and learn more about the book by going to our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. Just before the break, Jan Blodgett was talking about how common stories would come from, you would see, as you did these interviews, you would see different perspectives on the same event or the same person or the same story coming from different groups or different individual groups and groups of people. And Dr. Levering, you said that as you interviewed these 70 Davidsonians that you talked to, you heard one story at a time and it gradually evolved into a rich, common account. What does that mean?
Well, I may have overgeneralized in presenting that information.
Is there a common
you.
Thread running through there? Is it what,
yeah. Well, from our standpoint, the theme of the book, and I think what will make the book interesting to people who live in Charlotte and other places, not just in Davidson, is there is a theme which is civic engagement, which is people who have reached across the color line and across the class line of to try to make the town a better place, to actually deal with the town's problems, whether the problem was housing as a particular issue or racial issues, education early on, even education of slave children and families. There have been a lot of people in Davidson who've cared about the town and wanted to make it a better place. And I had no idea that there would be any particular theme when we started, when I got involved in this project in 2006. But it just runs through the town's history and is such an important part of it. At the same time, there's been some suspicion among the various groups in the town, and we talk about that. We don't try to sugarcoat the history. If to generalize, we could say that people associated with the college have been mostly white and mostly educated, and often have felt somewhat superior to the other people in town, that they were sort of the natural leaders of the town. And then the white people who worked at the shops on Main Street or owned local businesses are a second group, and there's been often some tension between those two groups. And then on the west side of the tracks, there have been the mill workers, who have felt a little bit left out by the people who live on the east side of the tracks and not having their interests taken into consideration very much. And then the fourth group, of course, is the African-American community, which is made up roughly one quarter of the town's population until the last 20 years when the town grew so rapidly. And the African-Americans have always been, certainly in the 20th century, there were some who were on the affluent side, even within the African-American community, but the majority were fairly poor. And so there's been that racial element in addition to class issues that has come into play. So we've been, there is a common thread of sort of a love for the town that, or a willingness to work together among the four groups. But at the same time, there's been this sort of resentment or suspicion that probably made it hard for Jan to reach across or get interviews, because They were probably afraid that these would be misused in some way or misinterpreted. So it's that mix of the two.
Well, as you know, it's said that history is written by the winners. And this is not exactly a war we're talking about here, where there are winners and losers, but there are different power struggles that have been going on in any community forever. Do collecting first-person stories, and as you said, some of these stories are about the same events, but they're from completely different points of view, and they may have a completely different viewpoint on what occurred. How do you arrive at the truth when you have different points of view? Because both of them may be equally valid. What is the truth? How do you check the veracity of it?
That is tricky, and there's also the issue of the people who are documented the most articulate people get to win because they've got all the documents, they've got the stories. So finding those other stories and getting them. For my point, my part of the book, I really wasn't trying to do an entire truth. It was more about a sense of how things were and trying to give multiple perspectives. So there's an example of a professor who is in charge of buildings and grounds, and he was writing a letter later talking about his interactions with African-Americans, and he's supposed to be hiring people, and he can't get people to work for the college. And they're paying more than people working in the fields. And he asks an African-American worker at the college, why won't anybody work for us? And the African-American says, it's the mental strain of being on campus. You don't have to worry about things if you're out in the field. And the professor, Carson, makes a very snide remark about this. Looking at, you know, years later and looking at African-Americans, what I know is the African-American told him the truth. Working on campus was a mental strain because if you were African-American on campus, anything that happened, you were going to get charged. If something went missing, you could be treated nice one day and you could be kicked off the next. So that tentative enough that having to be in white space was a mental strain. He told the truth. The other guy heard it differently.
Right.
So I'm trying to present it as, all right, this is what this guy heard. Think about what he really meant and what it means today. And can we understand that
And
story?
You can do that because you have the distance. You have distance of time and space. So you can be more what's the objective?
Distance and time and space. And also, you know, reading some accounts and talking to people who were African-American who worked at the college even recently about still that heritage of feeling under suspicion, you know, having to justify your place on the campus.
Right.
Kind of piece.
Well, I think the fact that we're both from other places has helped us be a little more objective, perhaps, than we otherwise were. I grew up in Carroll County, Virginia, near Mount Airy, which didn't like the slave system particularly. That was an area that was outside the slavery. There just weren't any blacks there. And so I don't have to sort of identify with the South that had slaves, which Davidson was certainly part of that area, and I know Jan doesn't either. But just to give an example, I think what you do is you present both perspectives. White people think integration of the schools in Davidson went really well, that everything was just so smooth when all the black kids came over to the white elementary school. But black people did not like the fact that their school was closed, the Ada Jenkins School, which was so central to their community. They felt a great loss, and so you have to get both of those perspectives in the book. You can't just go with one perspective or the other.
Put your headphones on. We'll take a call, and then we'll talk about some of the particular little nuggets of history that you uncovered over the course of writing this book. Vicki in Charlotte, you're on with Jan Blodgett and Dr. Ralph Levering. Welcome.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I work in the yearbook industry and helping schools produce school yearbooks, both at the college and high school and junior high, even elementary level. And I guess I'm wondering how much school yearbooks at all those levels help to tell the stories of a town and help you as archivists.
The college yearbook has been really helpful to me. Early on, they actually published over the years essays, people's reminiscences of the college. So there's footnotes in this book that happened from a yearbook because a guy from the class of 1850 wrote back about living in the town and describing the businesses, materials. Sometimes that was the only place we could find pictures of African-Americans because the students would include some photographs. Didn't always name them, but one thing that we found missing was we didn't have high school yearbooks. We did have a high school newspaper, and that was really helpful. But they are, and Davidson still produces, the college still produces a print yearbook. And as an archivist, I'm ecstatic about that. The video yearbooks aren't quite as good for what we need and for reusing them in the future. So I hope your company is doing both.
And they're very impractical, it seems to me. It's, if you, video yearbook, you have to put it in, you have to search for the, whereas you can just turn to a page and see a friend that you saw 20 years ago.
And the Davidson yearbooks are all online as well, on the archives page.
Are you doing both, Vicki? Are you doing both video and printed books?
Well, we're moving from video to more of an online presence that complements the print yearbook. We don't want to leave the print book because, as you know, technology changes so quickly that the print product really is the one that you can keep on the shelf forever.
Right.
So we're pretty... pretty happy with the print product as it is and hope that people find value in that. Obviously, with students now, particularly at the college level, they're so ingrained in their technology that the print book is sort of losing its value. I'm thrilled to hear that Davidson still has one because many colleges are dropping theirs.
Thank you for your call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
This book begins in 1836, 1837. It goes to the present day. You divided up your workload between the two of you. And I know that Dr. Levering, who's an expert on the Cold War, took the years, as I said, from 1941 to the present. Is that why? Because you're an expert on those years and you're more comfortable in the dusty past?
There's a bit of that. Most of my research, I've done a lot of 19th and early 20th century research. That is my comfort zone. And it is Ralph's. And part of it was I had gotten that far just in my researching and getting chapters done when I sort of stalled out. I was having difficulty. And Ralph's wife, Patty, wanted me to participate in a program that was going to take 2 years out of my life. And I said, Patty, I can't do that and do the book. And I'm feeling really guilty because the book is stretching out over time and people are dying and they haven't got it finished yet. And she said, just wait. And a couple of days later,
How much arm twisting went on behind the scenes?
None, actually. I was working on a project that could wait, and I realized that I needed to. This project would allow me to interview people in Davidson, and that's going to be the greatest legacy. This book will be the interviews that can be read 100 years from now, many of which, unfortunately, could not be included in the book. We couldn't quote everybody.
Right.
So,
are you making the transcripts of the interviews available in some form somewhere?
They're in the archives, and right now, if someone were to come in, we can pull them out and they can listen to the tape or read them.
How and where did you conduct these conversations?
I went to people's homes in most cases, and I'm sure Jan did the same thing.
Did you go with a list of questions? Did you just go and say, tell me a story? I mean,
I went with a list of 30 or 40 questions, and the interviews usually ran between an hour and 2 hours. But I was very flexible. If they had a story that wasn't included in my questions, I was to get that.
Did you tape record these, or did you?
Yes, we did. We have that on tape, and hopefully we'll digitalize those at some point, and also... they have been transcribed as well. But I actually, for my period of the book, the best stories came out of the funniest stories actually came out of the tapes. And I'd be glad to share one or two of those with you at some point.
I hope you will. That's why you're here. Let's go back to the very beginning, though. 1836, 37, somewhere in there when the college first started. What was this place we called Davidson like? When the college welcomed its first 65 students?
It was deliberately, basically in the middle of nowhere, which is
deliberately.
Deliberately. And that's pretty typical. I've worked at other institutions, and that's common for this era, that you wanted the students to be away from any distractions of the big city. So Davidson was basically equidistant between Salisbury, Statesville, and Charlotte. And the big money at that point was on Salisbury to be the big, big city of the three. Part of it was because there was land available, but this area had, in the 1820s, they had looked to place a college and were looking sort of in the same area. They wanted a high spot. We were the high spot between the Catawbas and Yadkin River. We didn't know at that point.
Why?
Well, we didn't know at that point why being close to water made you sick, but they were aware that pattern. They didn't know about mosquitoes and other diseases. But they knew that if you were near water but higher, that generally you didn't have the fevers that you had that plagued many cities in North Carolina. And at this point, there's no railroad. It's a long haul to get to this space. There are farms around here. There's, you know, there are churches in the area, so there's a little bit of a community to support it. But it's pretty much in the middle of nowhere, blank space.
That was one of my questions. My was going to be, what would entice a young person in 1837 to come to this place that was not even a dot on the map, a couple of buildings? Why would they come there as opposed to going to Chapel Hill, which I think was in existence back then, right?
Right. Chapel Hill is the first public university in the United States, so it's been around for several decades. Part of it would be our Presbyterian heritage, and that a lot of the young men who came were sent by their churches, were directed there. Their families felt it was a safer place than the evil state school. Not all of our students were Presbyterian. Some of it was just easier. You're from Western North Carolina, you're from this area, right, you're going to land here in Charlotte rather than going, you know, Charlotte folks are going to come up rather than going over to Eastern Carolina. I mean, to what was UNC at that point. We were really cheap. If you were a minister's son, you didn't have to pay tuition.
And how did you get there? Did people just ride horses? Did they walk? Did they?
Right, railroad horses. They came in carts and buggies. Got dropped off and then.
And it's a brand new school. So, I mean, how many buildings were there? Were there places to stay? Where? How did that happen?
There were basically four buildings, we think, maybe five. We built the president's house, which is still there, although it's a small corner of the building from the original still exists. We had at least two dormitories, the rows. We might have had three. And we had a chapel building. That's where chapel was held and also was the classroom building. Mm-hmm. And then it's going to take another 5-6 years before we get any other buildings.
It's fairly clear that the town of Davidson would probably not be there had it not been for the college being established there. But would the college have been able to thrive, expand, grow, et cetera, if the town had not concurrently grown up with it?
Probably not. And that was one of the things I was interested in is why does Davidson look like it does in 2012? Why is it a small college town as opposed to Chapel Hill, that's a big one, or Greensboro, where Guilford College is getting it started at the same time, you know, or so that's the interaction between the college and the town. The town really has to have all the surrounding farms. The merchants on Main Street sold coffins as well as pens and pencils because students weren't going to be their full business. But I think that the college did need to have the support of local businesses, of getting a train in so that students could come, the college could expand. We eventually really needed all the boarding houses because it turned out, because there was a fifth building, there was a steward's hall where students could eat. The college couldn't afford to actually feed its students, so we actually needed these surrounding people to make the college work.
Well, in fact, you write about students complaining about the food. This goes way back, doesn't it? And being allowed to eat in the boarding houses, which continued actually into the 20th century.
Right.
Because there wasn't a sufficient cafeteria system or because you couldn't afford it? Well, why did it continue into the 20th century?
I think in part because it was tradition. But the college was not. We think of Davidson now as this really elite, very well-endowed school. And we have been poor most of our lives. We have really not had lots of facilities, and it's really not until the 20th century. We've had campaigns throughout the school. Every once in a while, the college goes. They used to go to the churches and the presbyteries and say, fund us. We didn't really start having national or statewide campaigns until into the 20th century. So it was working well to have these boarding houses. It's World War II when the college rents its campus to the military that we have two campuses and we have to have a cafeteria.
Okay. We have to take a break. I want to come back and talk about alcohol, other student uprisings, and more into the 20th century here with Jan Blodgett and Dr. Ralph Levering, their book, One Town, Many Voices, The History of Davidson. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Paycor, providing cloud-based payroll, HR, and timekeeping solutions for over 20 years, serving over 22,000 companies across America with online solutions and personal service. Details at paycor.com. And Opera Carolina, performing Puccini's Tosca, October 13th, 18th, and 21st at the Belk Theater. For more info, 704-372-1000 or operacarolina.org. Coming up next on The Diane Rehm Show, the future of driving. A new California law allows self-driving cars on state roads. Proponents promise computer-controlled vehicles will reduce accidents and congestion. Guest host Tom Gelton and his guests discuss the future of driving in the digital age. That's the Diane Rehm Show this morning at 10 in about 20 minutes here on 90.7 WFAE. More Charlotte Talks is just ahead. Make your pledge right now to support WFAE and be automatically entered to win a trip for two to Prague and Budapest. We'll arrange air travel and 6 nights lodging. Of course, no pledge is necessary to win, but we hope you will. Become a new member today or consider renewing your pledge at WFAE.org and help shorten the pledge drive.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, Dr. Ralph Levering, Dr. Jan Blodgett also with us, both Davidson College affiliated, and they have written a book called One Town, Many Voices, A History of Davidson, North Carolina, which incorporates the history of the town and the history of the college. And you can read more stories about Davidson's history from davidsonnews.net and learn more about the book by going to our website, wfae.org/Charlotte Talks. I'm going to come back to the early days of Davidson in a second. But I don't want to run out of time before we talk about 1941 to the present, which was your assignment, Dr. Levering. You start in 1941, and the very first chapter that you write, I believe, is called Moving Forward Slowly, 1941 to 1960. Was that by design?
The moving forward slowly?
Yeah.
It was in a sense because, for example, in race relations, most people in the town were very committed to segregation. And that was not something people wanted to move forward on, even after Brown versus Board of Education. Mm. The college president would have liked to have integrated the school, but the Board of Trustees didn't want to do that. The local townspeople did not want integration to take place in the town. So the college remained all male, which after World War II, I think, begins to become a disadvantage for the town. I think some young men are wanting to go to co-ed institutions at that point. Not too many, but there's just a general conservatism in the town until the 1960s when things really break loose. I did want to mention the website for the book itself has just been put up. It's onetownmanyvoices.com, which the Davidson Historical Society has put up. And this book would not have been published in its present form and for a reasonable price without the Davidson Historical Society. So that has just been one of so many nonprofit organizations in Davidson that has been very public-spirited over the years.
Okay.
Just wanted to mention that.
The town and the college are so intertwined and have been since the very beginning, even after 1879 when the town became an entity unto itself, no longer governed by the college. And it seems to me that in that period of time from 1837 to the present, and we don't talk about this or think about this much, but a lot of wars were fought. And it is the young people, young men, who fight these wars. The Civil War, probably the Spanish-American War, World War I, World War II, Vietnam, etc. I know that you have wrote about the severe impact that World War II had on the college and on the town. Enrollment at the college declined precipitously because the boys went off to war. And that must have affected the town. And you write about the crushing sadness from the deaths of so many young people in this small area.
Mm-hmm. Right. There's almost an amusing story. It's sort of sad, but amusing at the same time. After Pearl Harbor, the president of the college, John Cunningham, wrote the War Department and said, could we have an exemption for our school? We're church-related, and many of our young men become ministers, so could you just allow us to continue as usual? And the War Department wrote back and said, I'm really sorry, but everybody has to serve. Everybody's getting drafted. But John Cunningham just knew that 90% of the student body would be leaving quickly to go off to war, and so where would the tuition be? How could the college even continue? And that, of course, had been a problem in the Civil War, too, where so many people had taken off.
Well, enrollment in World War II, I'm told, declined to under 200 people.
That's right. It did. Fortunately, the Army did put in a training program for people who were in the service but were not quite yet needed or in war theaters. And so the Department of Defense did put in, or the War Department did put in, quite a bit of money into the town and really helped to keep the college going.
Did something similar happen World War I, Civil War eras?
Not Civil War. And Civil War, we lost our student body. We claim to be the only school who did not close during Reconstruction, because Reconstruction was actually in some ways harder than the Civil War. Certainly we lost our student, but it was the no money, students needing to stay home to work on family farms, yeah, that really hurt colleges during that time period. World War I, very similar. We saw our student body and our faculty drop precipitously. We also then did a training so that we had soldiers on campus. So we were, again, two campuses in one and managed to survive by basically renting out the campus.
Hmm. You mentioned race relations earlier in this conversation. And several years ago, before he passed away, we had Ralph Johnson on the program. Mm-hmm. And he had a barbershop, a black barbershop in Davidson. And we went into great detail about the arcane rules that were governing barbershops back then. I mean, modernize, look at these rules and think how silly this all was. But there was a whole big brouhaha in 1968 surrounding his barbershop in Davidson, where student and faculty members boycotted the shop. Refresh our memories about that story, because I don't remember it that well.
Well, what happened, which he probably did not mention on the program, was that the boycott was actually sparked by Annie Mildred Lowry, who was a black woman in town who didn't particularly like Ralph Johnson, which was true of a lot of other black people in town. She worked at the college and told some of the students, pointed out that Ralph Johnson's barbershop was still segregated, only white hair was cut. Of course, Ken Norton's was too, the other Hood Norton's barbershop as well. So, but after the students were told that there was this injustice being done, even though what he was doing was legal under the Civil Rights Act of 1964, this was a great injustice that needed to be remedied, then a whole bunch of students and some faculty members began a boycott, saying we're going to force him to open his barbershop to people of all color. This was the great sort of Davidson civil rights story. Mm-hmm. And there was sort of great pride, and hundreds of students participated in one form or another in that, and faculty encouraged them. But Ralph Johnson was furious. He said, I've experienced discrimination from white people all my life, and here are some more white people associated with the college trying to ruin my business. He had built up his business. He was a middle-class person, and he had just opened a new barbershop that he owned, actually, on the corner of Main and Depot. He was very proud of his barbershop, had 8 or 9 barbers working with him. And so here are white people trying to destroy his business. And so he was a very proud person and was not going to give in until finally the barbers who worked for him said, we just are going to have to quit because we're not getting the business. And black people in town are also saying it needs to be integrated. So finally he gave in. But it was such a fascinating situation because with his pride, he wasn't wanting to give in on this.
And what
issue.
Was the upshot when he gave in, when he integrated his barbershop? Did he continue to be successful?
He didn't. And there are, again, multiple interpretations and perspectives on this. He thinks that it was mainly the forced integration and sort of some unruly black people hanging around his shop that kept people from coming in and discouraged the rural people from the area, white people, to come in and get cut. Whereas the white perspective on it was that our compulsory ROTC was ended at the college, so people didn't have to come in and get their hair cut every 2 weeks, and longer hairstyles for men were coming in, and so he was losing business anyway. So there. But he did close 3 years later in 1970.
Right. So how do you get to the truth of something like that? Because all of those things come into play. It's absolutely true.
Yeah.
So how do you, as an historian, how do you determine what story to tell?
I just try to tell it from all the different perspectives. I try to do that. And then on this case, I don't usually use metaphors very successfully in writing, but I like the metaphor that I used to describe what happened here, which was that it was two tectonic plates came into conflict. There was the slow-moving plate of segregation of the traditions and how things had always been done, and there was the fast-moving plate of integration and that kind of excitement about integrating everything that was happening in the 1960s. And those, it was two plates clashing in this situation, and you shouldn't really blame either side for what happened because it was just the circumstances at the time.
There were other instances of students' activism in Davidson. And going back to 1855, there was a student revolt. What was that about? What were they protesting and what form did it take?
They were protesting discipline. And this was not unusual. Colleges all over the country in the 1850s had pretty rowdy students. At Davidson, if you were a student, you could not go across the street to a store to buy food or snacks without faculty permission. You were supposed to be in your dorm rooms. Faculty could enter your dorm room 24/7 at any point. If you had closed the door and they had to damage it to get in, you had to pay for the damages. So you've got rowdy students, you've got faculty under control, you have got D.H. Hill, Daniel Harvey Hill, who's a mathematician. He is known for his attitude toward discipline. And it's almost Christmas break. There are students who are outside playing, goofing off and playing. Faculty see them. They run into their dorm rooms. One of the students and the faculty come in and they're asking who was outside. And all the students are like, not me, not me. And they find a student who's in his room, in bed, fast asleep, with his boots sticking off the end of the bed. And they're like, they kick him off campus. They say, you have violated the campus rules. It's within our right. You're out. So they throw him off campus. All the other students feel that this is a total injustice, that he wasn't given due process, that other people were involved. So they all just leave. They all just get on the train. They pack up the next morning. They leave the college. Most of them never come back. We graduate 8 students the next year. Three the next, I think. And it actually took the dying of Maxwell Chambers, a slave merchant and businessman in Salisbury, North Carolina, who's been on the Davidson Board of Trustees, has no children, who dies and leaves us the largest bequest. We have to sue the state of North Carolina because they've limited how much money we can have. To get all of the money, we're able to build a new campus building. And within about 6 years, we've moved ourselves back into a vital campus. But there was a very serious few years.
Did that result in the changing of the rules, the disciplinary rules?
No. It took a bit longer for that to happen. So.
There was another student riot in 1903 involving freshmen and sophomores, baseball, rocks, water, and 25 lashes.
Yes.
Tell that story.
Okay. This was purely internal. This was, if you were a student at that time period, you were with your class. You were the class of 1906. You were the class of 1905. That was you. You played sports together. You took all your classes together very, very tight. It was also the job of the sophomore class to inculcate the proper values to the freshman class, haze them into behaving. The class of 1906 is twice the size of the class of 1905. So you're a sophomore. You're supposed to be controlling this big, unruly class. They've been doing okay. It's spring. They play a baseball game. The freshmen win. Some freshman decides to paint the score on the columns of old Chambers. So the students have to see it as they come in. Then another student gets the brilliant idea of locking the sophomores into their banquet. They're having a big party across the street. They barricade the house. They grease the fence. Late in the morning, the sophomores discover this. They find all the students at another boarding house on North Main Street, and they have a battle. The freshmen are up on the second floor landing. They've got buckets of rocks, buckets of water. They're trying to defend themselves, and they finally realize the military rule of being higher isn't working for them because they can't get down. The sophomores are on the first floor. They can't get out. So they finally agree that they will allow each of the sophomores to give them the 25 lashes, and they'll be fine. Then after the sophomores leave, they all say this is not a good idea and decide that going to Charlotte for 2 or 3 days and letting things calm down would be a good plan. So they all leave. And actually, we managed to miss a fourth of the student body, more than a fourth of the student body, until lunch. And then they finally said, you know, like, we're missing some students here. Faculty have to run to the train station in Cornelius. They meet the students there. They bring them back. Ironically, the president's choice on this is to give him his front yard to battle it out. But they actually, the important piece of the story is that what the faculty realize is we can't do the kind of discipline we did in 1855. We're telling them they're not going to haze. This is a problem. And what we get is the student government and the honor code at Davidson enforced by students.
Let's go back to the present, or nearly the present. You talk a lot about racial integration in here, and you say that racial integration of the town of Davidson owes a lot to the women of the town. And you singled out several. What did they do to help integrate Davidson?
They did a lot of things. The women, especially from the Presbyterian Church, were just crucial. Both Presbyterian churches, both the white and the black church, were crucial. One of the things they did was daycare, set up daycare. This was before there was daycare and even before there was kindergarten, but they wanted to help people of both races get ready for school and get started. And so Pat Sailstead actually set up daycare in her home and then used the Episcopal Church as for recess. And then they set up the Davidson Cornelius Daycare Center, raised money for that, built a building. Adelaine Ostwald went over and taught in the Eddie Jenkins School for a year and then worked with integrated classes. So they just kept thinking of ways to do that.
David on Facebook writes, when I lived in Boston, I became aware that many people there live and breathe history. They not only read the many books written about the various local histories, they feel that they may well wind up in future history books. I wish more people here had such an awareness and willingness to help shape our future history. Maybe this and other books will help toward that end. Thanks. Can't wait to read it. Email from Donald. He says, how can I buy this book? Can't find the information online. As a historian, I'm very interested in this. So how can they buy this book?
Online, they can go through the college bookstore. That's actually the link. And if you go to onetownmanyvoices.com, there is now a link on there to get you to an online. And we appreciate it. And actually, Davidson does have, and there's a Ralph Johnson book, which I recommend anyone to read. David played a harp. And we've had several other people write memoirs of the town, which was helpful in writing it and, you know, supporting my campaign of I want people to tell stories. I want to capture them. The Community School of Davidson, students are going to be doing StoryCorps on the town green on Town Day for us. So we're going to try and get five-minute excerpts of Davidson history all day Town Day.
Dr. Jan Blodgett and Dr. Ralph Levering collaborated on One Town, Many Voices. Thanks for the hour.
Thank you.